Thank you very much, Kevin. Well, it's a real honor to join Dr. Sventon Frieden in welcoming you tonight on behalf of the American STD Association. I'll be very brief, as I've heard Dr. Fagy speak several times, and I can tell you that you're in for a real treat, and you don't want me cutting into his time. Mostly, I want to thank you all very much for coming on behalf of the ASTDA. As Kevin noted, I'm the president. And I also want to just take a moment to emphasize my gratitude to the Scientific Advisory Committee, whose members reviewed all of the abstracts and were really essential to constructing the conference. It's also been an honor to serve as a co-chair with Dr. John Douglas and to work with Judy Lipschitz in the Division of STD Prevention, as well as Lynn Barkley at ASHA, who provided the organizational support for the conference. And then finally, I really was going to be brief, and I will be brief. I just want to highlight two events that ASTDA is co-sponsoring during the conference. First of all, I want to be sure that you come to the networking event that we are having on Wednesday night. As Kevin mentioned, the Georgia Aquarium is actually a lovely venue. You need your badge to get in, or you can also purchase additional tickets if you want to at registration. And I understand that the belugas were out of town, but they're back. So you can be among the first to welcome them back and mingle with your colleagues. The second thing I just want to let you know about is that the ASTDA does have an annual award ceremony at which we recognize contributions to the field. And this year, we have a really stellar group of people. Hunter Hansfield will be receiving the Thomas Perrin Award and will be giving a lecture entitled Stones Unturned, Missed Opportunities in STD HIV Prevention. I'm sure Hunter will entertain and enlighten us, as he always does. And then Harold Chesson from CDC will receive the Achievement Award, and Jared Baton from the University of Washington will receive the Young Investigator Award. So please do join us. I think it'll be a wonderful event, and share the festivities and celebrate with our colleagues. So again, thank you for coming. I hope you have a great time and get a lot out of the conference and a lot from your colleagues, and I'll turn the podium back to Kevin.
So, ladies and gentlemen, it's truly an honor for me to share this afternoon's plenary with the director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Dr. Thomas Frieden, and with former CDC directors, Dr. Bill Fagy and Dr. David Sensor. I'd like to especially welcome Dr. Fagy and Dr. Frieden to this first day of the National STD Prevention Conference. Dr. Fagy is our keynote speaker tonight, and Dr. Frieden will be introducing him. We'll also be hearing from Dr. Frieden later this week, later in the conference, at our closing plenary on Thursday morning. Also, I'd like to note that Congressman John Lewis is unable to be with us today, as he had to be in Washington, D.C. for some unexpected activities. So you will hear more about Dr. Frieden later in the conference when he delivers the closing address. But suffice it to say, we are really delighted to have Dr. Frieden at the helm of this agency. And since his arrival at CDC in June of last year, we have seen substantial changes in our organization's structure, focus, and responsiveness. While leading CDC's response to the H1N1 epidemic and more recently to the Haiti earthquake disaster, Dr. Frieden has consistently articulated his commitment to strengthening the epidemiology and surveillance support that the agency provides, to strengthen our support for state, tribal, local, and territorial programs, to strengthen CDC's role in health policy, to accelerate and strengthen our health impact, and of course, to strengthen our activities and focus in global health. A new organizational structure is now in place at CDC to meet these priorities and to ensure that the agency is fit for purpose for the challenges ahead. So now, please join me in welcoming Dr. Thomas Frieden, the 16th Director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
The organizers knew that I never miss a chance to hear Bill Fagy speak, so they figured they'd take advantage of my being here to ask me to introduce him. But that's not an easy thing to do, particularly because a few years ago I was sitting in the front row of a conference while Bill was being introduced, and he leaned over and said, "The unspeakable torture of hearing yourself be introduced." So that's a low bar to follow. You know, STD, though, is an area that's critically important. And I've thought about how lately we've been getting criticized for telling people what to eat, and we've been telling people how to have sex for decades. STDs tend to be really underfunded, underrecognized, underappreciated. And I think that's a reason why you have three current or former directors here with a commitment to really look at STD as an area where more needs to be done and more commitment needs to be made. I used to say when I was health commissioner in New York City that we were desperately trying to get funds to renovate our STD clinics. And for $1 million, we would name our STD clinic after you. For $5 million, we would not name it after you. And for $10 million, we'd name it after the person of your choice. STD, as you all know, has been a core training and proving ground for people throughout the public health world, learning how to interact with the public, learning how to make a difference, learning how to look at epidemiology, learning how to do contact investigations and elicit contacts from a rock, as people have told me STD workers can do. And this is something that we're committed to resuming, this pipeline of tomorrow's generation of public health leaders and managers. No one could be better to start this conference off than Bill Foege, who first and foremost is a superb epidemiologist who was chief of CDC's smallpox eradication program in the 1970s, also worked to eradicate guinea worm, has worked on polio and measles and river blindness, was CDC director from 1977 to 1983. In 1984, co-founded the Task Force for Child Survival, which was critically effective at expanding immunization programs, served as senior advisor to the Gates Foundation, where he continues as senior fellow, advisory board member at Emory University, presidential distinguished professor emeritus of international health at Rollins School of Public Health at Emory University, executive director of the Carter Center from 1986 to 92, and continuing as a health policy fellow there. But more than anything else, I think, Bill Foege has been a voice for public health as a tool for social justice. And for that, he has inspired us and continues to inspire us, and we look very, very much forward to hearing what you have to say.
Thank you, Tom. If you followed Tom's career from CDC to India to New York and back to CDC, you know it's been a spectacular career, and CDC is very fortunate to have him as director. Thanks very much for inviting me for your version of the Antiques Roadshow. I've been involved in public health since joining the Seattle King County Health Department 52 years ago. STD control is in the category STDs are in the category of things that no one notices if you do them well. And there are many stories that should be told. I think of the early days of HIV and how Paul Wiesner and a small group of STD investigators were the first ones out trying to figure out what was going on. And if the world doesn't actually understand what you do, I hope that this conference makes you very appreciative of what you and other people are doing so that you acknowledge the value of the work you've done in the past and the work that you will do in the future. I recently fell and ended up with surgery on my shoulder, and my four-year-old granddaughter sent me a get well card. So I called her on the phone and said I enjoyed the flowers that she drew and the colors she used to paint them. And there was silence, and she said, "What else?" And so I said, "I enjoyed the words and the other pictures. What else?" And when you leave this conference, which I hope you enjoy tremendously. I hope you are asking, but what else? Because there is more, and your work will never be done. With students, I often use the story of the Battle of Chancellorsville, which was in May of 1863. And for those of you who do not know the story, this was the height of the Confederacy. Stonewall Jackson was so clever as he outflanked the federal troops. He was helped somewhat by General Hooker being drunk, but nonetheless, it was quite a move. And the Confederacy won that battle. But I tell them about a man by the name of Thomas Allen, Colonel Thomas Allen from Wisconsin, who rallied his troops. And the people who lived said they remembered his words the rest of their life. This is what he said. When the signal forward is given, you will start at double quick, and you will not stop until you get the order to halt. He waited, and then he said, and you will never get the order to halt. And that's the way it is with STDs. You will never get the order to halt. And so I hope you ask, what else? I'd like to talk about three things. A few words about STDs, something about the healthcare reform process that's going on. And then ask the question, are there still lessons that could be learned from something such as smallpox eradication so that whatever happens to healthcare reform, we're asking the question, does any of this apply to STDs? STDs. What we do with STDs is part of what we do with public health in general. That is, we try to eliminate premature mortality, we try to eliminate unnecessary suffering, and we try to improve the quality of life. Of these, Schweitzer once said, suffering is a greater burden than death itself. But yours is a hard part of public health because of stigma. Suffering with an STD is a burden because it's not something you tell other people about. And so, therefore, you get no sympathy, you have no one bringing you dinner, or soup, or flowers, or students sending you get well cards. STD work has, though, obviously been so important for individuals, but it's very important for CDC. Many of you know the story of Johannes Stewart after the Second World War starting this elite group of STD investigators. And it produced people like Bill Watson, who were problem solvers, and you still are today, you're problem solvers. And this group then became the managers at CDC. Public health isn't just science. It's built on science, of course, and it's built on the principles of epidemiology. But the improvement of health comes from applying that science through a process called management. And these STD core people became the managerial backbone of CDC. And I hope you read the new book that's out on the public health advisors at CDC. Healthcare in the United States. I don't know what's brought you to this moment, but I can make some assumptions. One, you're not fatalists, or you wouldn't be here. You actually believe you can change the future, your own future and the future of other people, and of course you can't. Public health is not a gathering place for fatalists. And some of you have real complaints against the universe, and you want to change them. And I would remind you that the world belongs to the discontented. It belongs to those who want to see a difference, who want to dream big dreams, who want a different future than just going along. And having said that, it's likely, but not for sure, that we share the dream of righting the wrong in healthcare in this country. It's important for equity. It's important for social justice. It's important for better approaches to STDs. In medical school, you hear continuously, do no harm. It's not until you leave school that you find out that this was a pretty empty statement. as great as it sounds, it was an empty statement because it doesn't apply if you're interested in prevention. If you don't get paid for promoting prevention in clinical practice, you don't have to promote it, which means there are caveats to do no harm. In the 1950s, the AMA told us to avoid socialized medicine. At that time, I still had enough respect for authority that I bought into this argument, and I was on the alert for socialism. No one seemed to see capitalism gaining on us, and no one would have thought capitalism could be worse than socialism. But I will tell you that it's capitalism that has ruined the healthcare system in this country. By making profit, the bottom line, and despite the propaganda that I've heard over a lifetime, some things don't lend themselves to correction by the marketplace, such as solving the tobacco problem, improving water supplies, waste disposal, or preventing flu, or solving STD problems. The marketplace has no driving ambition that would have allowed it to eradicate smallpox, and no driving ambition to improve health, only to improve the health care delivery system, which provides profit. And those things require collective action. And one role of public health is to continue to define what is unacceptable and figure out how to fix that. If Ron Paul would have his way, even flu would be handled by the marketplace, and he said that explicitly. We would find the marketplace would need to sell vaccine and Tamiflu, not prevent the virus spread. For all of my general optimism, health care in this country leaves me depressed. This country that takes pride in the marketplace has seen our capitalists let all of us down in the last several years, quite aside from healthcare. And greed has clouded the basic tenet of civilization, which is how we treat each other. The country that takes pride in its managerial abilities falls back on saying we have the best healthcare system in the world. And it must be obvious, even to those who are saying that, that we're spending so much more money and we have poor results than other countries. The country that has taken pride in a democracy that's been a shining beacon on the hill for the world is now served by some of the most selfish, power-hungry congressional people that I've ever seen. It was Isocrates, 2,000 years ago, who actually said, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. You will probably think it was Lord Acton that said that, but he plagiarized it. So Isocrates said this 2,000 years ago, but Paul Warnke in our lifetime improved it by saying, that may be true, but the most corrupting of all is the fear of loss of power. And that's what we see with dozens and maybe even hundreds of people in Congress who so fear losing their power that they are willing to sell us out. And those that are good seem to be announcing every day that they will not run for re-election because they don't want to continue working in a cesspool. This is a concern for us because, for many reasons, but in addition, because people don't really differentiate between politicians and government workers. And so we all get tarred by this feeling that is now going around the country. And I'll tell you, there is no other organization other than government that actually has concern for all of us. Try to think of some other organization, no church group, no social group, actually has concern for all of us, only government. Ron Paul, who says that healthcare is so complex that it can only be solved by the marketplace, apparently missed the fact that the marketplace can't even take care of the marketplace. And it destroyed lives, took homes, left millions unemployed, and reduced hope. And as I said at the CDC lecture on Joe Mountain some months ago, there's a real competition for the most ridiculous statement to be made by Congress, but I would probably choose Senator John Ensign, who said too much is made of the U.S. health indices not being as good as other countries. He said that if you remove highway deaths and gunshot deaths from the total, our mortality figures are quite competitive. As John Stewart said, that's like saying, if you remove my affair, I'm almost monogamous. And the health insurance industry leaves me frustrated. You know, we don't actually need them. A single payer system would save enough money to cover all of those without health insurance. And they are killing the idea of a public plan, saying it would give government a foot in the tent. They apparently have missed Medicare, Medicaid, the military, the VA, the public health system. On the other hand, they argue that it would be unfair competition because they are more efficient. The government programs are more efficient than the healthcare insurance system. And five companies just posted profits of $12 billion in the last year as they announced an increase in premiums. So it's managed by financial wizards who have discovered various ways to increase their own bank accounts through such things as derivatives. What are derivatives, by the way? Derivatives would be the equivalent of surgeons placing side bets that their colleagues' patients won't make it through surgery. That's what a derivative is. They would make money over the disaster of someone else, and we wouldn't stand for this in health. We don't even let basketball players bet on games. So why do we tolerate this in the financial circles? And I realize there's no shortage of greed in government, but the driving force in government is still protection and advancement of all of us. And this fear of government has some rationale. It does run over the rights of some people. It has detained people. It has tortured. But I can tell you, when I want protection from the flu, or anthrax, or food poisoning, or hospital infections, and three of those four I've had, I want to call on the nation's public health system, not Wall Street. Zimbardo, in his book, The Lucifer Effect, recounts the 1971 Stanford experiment with students, where some became prisoners and some became guards, and it was arbitrary. But both groups were corrupted within days. Zimbardo was actually the teacher, and he served as the warden for that prison. And he didn't realize until his girlfriend told him, "You've become corrupted yourself," what he had done, and he stopped the experiment. But he's written a book now. What did we learn? And he looks at the many disasters, such as Catholic priests abusing children, Enron, other health, and our healthcare system, and he says, we're always looking for bad apples, and there are bad apples, but that the real problem is a bad barrel. And that's what I think we have in Congress and the health insurance industry, bad barrels that allow people to do bad things without anyone having any control. But the opposite is also true, and that's the end of the book, and that's the hopeful thing. By creating good barrels, average people perform even better than average. And that is the secret of public health. Now let's apply that to healthcare delivery. Just because we are being stiff-armed by Congress and the health insurance industry, that doesn't let us off the hook. It's important that we not let this chance at reform just disappear. What are some things we could do? Three fixes that I would suggest. First, that public health develop the metrics to measure health outcomes. If you can actually measure health outcomes rather than health processes, you could reward the programs that improve the outcomes. And then if we come up with a system, and we can stay right where we are with the current insurance system, but if we develop a system that gives additional rewards to the programs that meet certain measures for 100 million person days of experience. And then if we could go beyond that and give even more rewards for people who are in high risk categories, including the poor, obese, smokers, diabetics, suddenly insurance companies would have a reason to include prevention. And you would see them devising smoke-ending programs, exercise programs, nutrition programs, diabetes best practice programs, blood pressure best practices, STD detection and treatment. In a word, prevention would become part of healthcare delivery. Altruism, like evil, is readily responsive to situational forces, and the marketplace could then provide the best outcomes in the world. Second, I would urge public health people to go into politics. And I say this sincerely, I've said it now for years, that it's labor intensive for us to be providing the kind of information politicians need, and then they turn over. But if we could get public health people to go into politics, we could shortcut the process. Now, I realize some of you would even become corrupted. But I would rather start with people who chose their career on some basis other than making money. This is a service that you could provide this country, a big, big service, and so you should consider it. Third, promote the idea that programs that have positive cost-benefit ratios should become entitlements. It used to bother me at CDC when we would have a program such as a measles program where you could show a dollar invested saved this country $10, and yet we had to each year go up to Congress and we had to argue that case against other programs that had positive benefit cost ratios. Once there's a demonstrated positive benefit cost ratio, this should become an entitlement and we don't have to argue it every year. If Congress could be held to average health care, everything would improve. And to paraphrase Leon Trotsky, everyone has the right to be stupid on occasion, but Congress is now abusing that privilege. Finally, whatever the result of reform, what could we do about STDs? Well, I once took a class on creativity, and the instructor gave each of us one word, and then we had to write down what's the next word that came to mind, and the next word, until we had 50 words on a piece of paper. Then he said, take some problem that you've had at work that you just can't seem to solve, and now take that problem and one by one go through the list of 50 words, and he said, I'll guarantee you, you will come up with something you haven't thought about before. For me, I thought of three things after 50 words. So creativity is often expressed as thinking outside the box. It isn't at all. It's thinking inside two boxes. Two pieces of information that you have, but now you put them together in a new way and it's creative. You think of something else. It's just like humor. With humor, things are funny only because you know the second part of it, but you just didn't see it that way before. If you have to explain a joke, there's no humor in it. And so when Henny Youngman says that his grandmother is 80 years old and she still doesn't need glasses, you get a picture. And then he adds, she drinks right out of the bottle. It's a second picture, but it comes together, and it's funny because you didn't think of it that way. So that's what creativity is about. So I'm going to mention some things that worked in smallpox. And in your mind, put STDs against that and see if anything new comes to mind today or in the future. Number one, smallpox eradication did not happen by accident. Stephen Hawking, in his book, A Short History of Time, said that the history of science is the gradual realization that things do not happen in an arbitrary fashion. It's a cause and effect world. And every improvement in STDs will be because of deliberate decisions you make, not luck, not chance. Number two, know the truth. That is the reason for surveillance systems. To know the truth, because knowledge is power. Number three, management. We need scientific information, but the key skill in public health is management. Acquire the best available. Don't cede this to the corporations. There are plenty of managers who, like you, find joy in improving health rather than counting money. Number four, coalitions. Gary Will wrote a book about the Gettysburg Address and how in those 272 words or whatever it is, how Lincoln changed this country so that United States went from being a plural noun to a singular noun with that one speech. That's what coalitions are about. A singular approach where you get people in and you have a coalition, and the magic of the coalition is that it suppresses individual egos for a common goal. Coalitions should include everyone that can help, including corporations. And if you read the New York Times piece on Andrew Witty at Glaxo, you recognize that corporations, pharmaceutical companies, have some of the people we need in STDs. Merck and Glaxo and Pfizer are becoming engines of change in global health. Cultivate them. Number five, social will is crucial. Court it. Number six, help every person on the team become a delivery person and a researcher, always asking the question, how could we improve what we're doing? Number seven, every public health decision ultimately requires a political decision. Take it as part of your job description to get the right information to the right people before they make bad decisions. Number eight, evaluation is key to interpret where the deficiencies are. The mantra of the American Management Association was repeated hundreds of times in smallpox. You get what you inspect, not what you expect. Know the truth. And finally, the lesson of humility is important. Smallpox eradication in retrospect seems inevitable, but the chain of events allowed so many opportunities for failure that everyone involved was apprehensive until the end. And in the end, we found that the problems were not due to the nature of smallpox. The problems were due to the nature of people. And this is even more true with STDs. While the lessons are many, what's the greatest gift of smallpox eradication? It takes us right back to the first lesson, that is, this is a cause and effect world. It's the demonstration, once again, that the coordinated action of dedicated people can plan a rational future. This does not have to be a world of STDs and plagues and disastrous governments and conflict and uncontrolled health risks. It is possible to plan a rational future, and we should settle for nothing less. We should settle for nothing less. Thank you.
Dr. Feige, thank you so much for an incredibly inspiring opening address. Colleagues, we will have time for questions from the floor, and I'd like to invite you. There are microphones which are located in the aisles. If you have questions that you'd like to put to Dr. Feige, he'd be very, very happy to respond to them. Yes.
Would you like to answer from there and use this mic, or do you want to go stand at the podium?
It's on. Just speak closer to the mic. Yeah. No.
I think I can. I can. Yeah.
Here, this one's on.
That's it.
No, here, this one.
Okay, we're getting a mic to you.
I'll start from the beginning.
That seems like...
Yes. Sorry about that.
That seems like improved technology now.
That's kind of what I'm aiming for. So my name is Raman Bastani, and I appreciated the inspiring words you had said about changing the world and wanting to make a difference. And at the risk of embarrassing myself in front of so many qualified people here in the STD prevention world, I think I have a way that will help dramatically reduce STDs. And the idea is something I'm launching in a few weeks called Cupid Me. It's with a Q, QPID. And the idea is to help people make better decisions before they have sex. And we'll do this by verifying their STD results and making them easily and securely accessible by way of text messaging, for instance, in person. You can text the company and get the results back right away of the person who is allowing you to see their results, and also online by sharing your results by way of a secure link. And my question is, what role do you see technology, specifically text messaging, playing in the future of STD prevention?
Well, I just happen to be an expert in that field. No, but I agree with you, and I want to give you a different example of technology that two students came up with. A third of all of the drugs used in Africa are felt to be adulterated. They are either placebos, there's nothing in them, or that something has been changed, but you don't know which third. And so two students from Ghana came up with the idea that just as you play the lotto and you scratch off and get a number, why not have that on every bottle of pills that you get at the pharmacy? You scratch it off, you use your cell phone to call a number, and then you put that number in, and the manufacturers verify that that is in fact a good drug. Now, it's such a simple thing, and it's like what you're talking about. So that's part of creativity, is how to use the new technology for old problems. In Botswana, we've had a program for HIV that is a program with the Gates Foundation, Merck, Harvard, and the government of Botswana. And when I first went there, maybe 9 years ago, people called AIDS a radio disease, because people would talk about it on the radio, but they never talked to each other about it. And it was true that there was no talk about this, and you'd go to funerals, and no one would say that this is what the person died of. They always died of tuberculosis. I went on rounds at a hospital, and probably 90% of the patients were HIV patients, and that was never mentioned. And afterwards, we met in a small room, and I asked the person in charge, the medical officer in charge, how do you do this? How do you get up every morning and come into this? And what are you doing about your mental health? And I almost immediately regretted having asked that question, because he sat there and stared and didn't say anything. And there he was with his staff there, the people had come to visit, and suddenly tears started rolling down his face. And he said, I'm one of four sons. My three brothers have died of AIDS. I don't have a choice. 6 years later, you go to Botswana, 7 years later, and where the original rate of HIV in newborns was 40%, it has dropped to 4%. And it's happened because people have asked, how can we use our science and technology under African conditions? And one of the parts of this that I found really intriguing was a radio show, a soap opera, that became so popular that most everyone in Botswana listened to it, and it dealt with AIDS. And so when I went back, I went to a testing clinic, and there was a couple from the university, and I talked to them, asked them why they were getting tested. These two people had not had sex, and they had made an agreement they would get tested before. And no one would have talked about this 8 years earlier. And they said they learned this from the soap opera. But my point is that, yes, we obviously have to keep asking the question, how do we use the new technologies and even the old technologies, such as radio, to improve what's happening?
Thank you so much. I have a policy question for you. We have all watched and suffered while Congress told us that condoms were weapons of mass destruction and that we can't give young people the kind of information that they need. So there are probably a lot of people in here who've been banging, we've been banging our heads against that wall. And I would really love to hear, short of running for office, because we don't want to join the cesspool, what kinds of things that you think that we can do? We are researchers, we are, you know very well, there are people running STD clinics, there are people from industry. What do you believe that we can do, short of running for office, that would have an impact?
Well, I think the atmosphere has changed so much that you should be exploiting this new atmosphere. Why not have a public health group analyze what happened over the last 8 years and what were the mistakes made, and a high-level group say, this should not have happened. I mean, it's like torture. So I think that's part of it. But the other thing is, how do you get other people to be your surrogates so that it's not the government coming out with this? How do you get other people to do that? Now, I've been very surprised compared to the early days of HIV, for instance, at how the churches have picked up on this. At one time, that was not a very popular thing for churches to even look at. And obviously, there will be some churches that will still be in this category of you cannot use condoms. But I would ask how to get them involved. So I would be looking for other places, the educators, the social clubs, Rotary. Rotary has enjoyed what it's done with polio. I almost said the way it's gotten mired down in polio because they thought it was going to be a lot shorter. But they really do like what they're doing, and they will be looking for other things to do. So get others to be your surrogates.
Thank you. We have another question.
Is this one on?
Yes. It is.
The rate of new HIV/AIDS diagnoses among young black men has, specifically adolescents, nearly doubled between 2004 and 2007. And 85% of those were among men who are attracted to men. So we're talking young black gay men. And that's a highly marginalized population, marginalized in both the gay community and the African American community, yet the infection rates are skyrocketing. And it doesn't seem to have gotten much attention. Do you have any suggestions in your long career as to how to bring the public spotlight to a highly marginalized population?
Well, you know, that is what public health has been doing for so long, at looking at marginalized populations. And we heard at the beginning the phrase social determinants of health. And that's what you're describing, that the biggest determinants of health in the world have to do with such things as poverty, lack of education, being marginalized in some way. Question that I would ask, I don't know the answer to your question. The question I would ask, though, is why is this happening? Why have they not gotten the message? Or if they have gotten the message, why is it that they're not listening to the message? Why is it that they feel they don't need to listen? So I would start with that, trying to figure out what's going on. And then I would see what could be done to empower them. I mean, we talk about this all the time, of empowering the socially marginalized, and in many ways it feels like a Band-Aid, that we're not really dealing with the problem when we talk about that. But if you want to see what can happen with empowerment, go to the website of TOSTAN, T-O-S-T-A-N. We have heard over the years declarations that come out of Cairo and other places against genital mutilation for women in Africa. And by and large, these declarations mean nothing. I mean, everybody feels good that they got it passed and so forth. But in Senegal, a woman actually was not even aiming at this problem. She was trying to figure out, how do you allow women in Africa who have very little power, and this, by the way, is the basis for AIDS in Africa, is women have no power, and yet they have to do all the work. And so they have power in a certain sense. But her question was, how could you get women together to do something for themselves in a village? And in this village, what did they decide? They decided they did not like what had happened to them with genital mutilation. And they did not want this to happen with their daughters. They went to the chief of the village, and he said, I can't do anything about that. If we stopped doing that, then our young women would not be marriageable to the surrounding villages. These women would not give up. And he finally brought in 7 or 8 chiefs of neighboring villages. And those women were so persuasive, they got 7 chiefs to all agree to stop this. Now, this is a very local thing, except now it's spread to include millions and millions of people. It's in 6 countries in Africa. I can tell you that genital mutilation is a thing of the past. The tipping point has been reached. This is going to spread through Africa, and not because of any UN agency, not because of any health agency, because it started with empowering women in one village. So that's, in general, what I would ask, is how do you give these young men power that they see a future? See, the opposite of empowerment is fatalism. And with fatalism, you feel like you have no control of your future. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why poor people take up better health plans at such a low rate. They don't actually feel that they can influence their future. In this country, something like a third of people feel they don't have control over their future. In some countries, it's as high as 90%. Now, all of us fluctuate day to day by how much power we feel we have and which areas. And I used to tell students that I'm most fatalistic when I get in a taxi cab. that I've lost control. And I tell them about the night I got in a taxi in Philadelphia, and it's not that far from the airport downtown. But I suddenly smelled alcohol. And then I wondered, what kind of a risk am I taking? So I said to the driver, you should know that I'm a high-risk passenger. And he said, what does that mean? And I said, well, I've been in 5 taxi accidents in my life. And his immediate response was, that's nothing. I've been in a lot more than that. But fatalism is a real thing, and that's what's happening, I would guess, in that marginalized group. And so find out why, and what does it take to give them power?
Great. So we have time for a couple of questions. There's one at the microphone. I'm going to ask if you could take the question at the microphone. So
yeah, hello. Bruce Trigg from New Mexico. Thank you so much for your remarks. I'm a longtime single-payer activist, so this was music to my ears. So for the last number of years, you know, harm reduction became a forbidden term in public health. Condoms were, of course, taken off sort of downgraded as a public health tool. Gun violence stopped being studied by the CDC. How do we prevent next time a group of politicians come along with an agenda? How do we protect public health, the integrity of public health in the future? So we don't have to go through this after each political change.
I don't actually know the answer to that. I mean, it's one of the things that frustrates me, that we are in this situation. We're at a time in the world where science and technology have so much to offer, and we are as scientifically illiterate now as we probably were 30 years ago. And I don't understand why that's true. Some newspapers provide more inches to the horoscopes than to hard science. And so how is it that you're able to get people into horoscopes but not understanding the science? And you know, the recent thing on autism and vaccines, the information was really quite clear about this man from England and his paper. What I didn't know was that he was actually getting money from a lawyer who was suing vaccine producers. That would have made it clear to everybody if we'd known that at the beginning. Nonetheless, it was very hard to get people to focus on this. And so we had study after study, and think of the money consumed in doing these studies, and each one showing there's no relationship to autism and vaccine use, and yet it didn't change what was happening in the community. I happen to live on an island in Puget Sound, Vashon Island, and it was featured in the front page of the New York Times because 16% of children were not immunized on Vashon Island. We have a lot of free thinkers, and the autism problem really caught on there. And it was very hard to get good science into this. So I don't know the answer to how do you avoid having that happen in the future. I think our newspapers let us down a great deal, and we've relied on them so much. Now, I don't know if you saw in the New York Times today that the National Enquirer is up for a Pulitzer Prize. No. Yeah. And you know why? Because they were the only ones that went after John Edwards and his affair. Everyone else decided not to follow up on that. It tells you something about what's happening to newspapers, and what is happening is, you know, one newspaper in Seattle has now folded. This is going to happen around the country. The New York Times will be the last one standing, but someday the New York Times will go. And I'm not sure that the substitutes, which seem so good to so many people, will actually do the kinds of things the newspapers used to do. But I'm glad you brought it up so that everyone here is thinking about this and worrying about that. We have a lot of things that I don't know the answer to. See, last century was the century of physics. This century is the century of biology. And I can tell you the United States has lost its lead in biology and will never get it back. And if that isn't sad, not because it makes a difference who discovers things, we still get to use them, but that our leaders could not see this coming. And it's a combination of things. After 9/11 that we made it so difficult for the best students to get into the United States that we lost a lot of them. We've seen the programs in India and China improving so fast that they're putting out far more people than we're putting out in the sciences. We now have Americans going to India for their postgraduate work. We've had the stem cell problem that has stopped certain kinds of biological research. And I can tell you, we'll never get the lead back. And that is sad. So there are a lot of problems, but we should recognize them even if we can't solve them.
Thank you. And the final question for the evening.
Everybody applaud you for empowering women in Africa. However, how can a woman protect herself if the condom is not an option for her, not only in Africa, but everywhere in the world? How a woman can protect herself if she has no option for the condom and the male refuses to use the condom?
And you're absolutely right. This is the beauty of Toston. Those women now realize that collectively they can do things they could not have done individually in the past. And they will be able to go from taking one problem to other problems. But you're absolutely right. That's a problem in Africa that is not easily solved. But it's worth trying to solve. I mean, there are so many problems. I'm talking to students in Texas this week, and they want to know how they could be spending their lives. I went back to look at William Wilberforce and what he did for slavery. And this man had such tenacity that he introduced the bill against slavery trade for 20 years in a row, and always lost. And yet he kept doing it. And so I'm going to tell these students that you will be getting skills and knowledge, and you'll be working in all kinds of areas. But a place you can start right now is looking at poverty. Because poverty is the slavery of today, and everyone in this room benefits because we have poverty. We get fast food at a lower price because people are working at minimum wage. Our clothes are cheaper because we have people in this country and other countries working at minimum wage or sub-minimum wage, which means they're subsidizing us. Our prices are better because poor people are subsidizing us. And you know, you can't tolerate that. You can't feel good about that. It's not something that will change overnight, but it's something that students and others could be bringing to the fore every day and saying, this is wrong. And if you say it long enough and often enough, and with enough force, society will change.
Colleagues, please join me in thanking Dr.